Maggie Rose Dunn was in darkness again. She could see shapes all around her. She knew what they were, and where she was, even why she was there. She was thinking about escaping again, but the warning jumped into her head, always the warning. If you try to escape, you won't be killed, Maggie. That would be too easy. You'll be put under the ground again. You'll go back in your little grave. So don't ever try to escape, Maggie Rose. She was starting to forget so much now. Sometimes she couldn't even remember who she was. It all seemed like a bad dream, like lots of nightmares, one after another. Maggie Rose wondered if her mother and father were still looking for her. Why would they be? It was so long ago that she'd been kidnapped. Maggie understood that. Mr. Sneegee had taken her from the day school. But then she never saw him again. There was only the warning. Tears filled her eyes. It wasn't so dark now. Morning was coming. She wouldn't try to escape again. She hated this, but she never wanted to go under the ground again. Maggie Rose knew what all the shapes were. They were children, all in just one room of the house, from which there was no escape.
Jesse came back to Washington a week after the trial ended. It seemed like a good time for beginnings. We talked over the phone some, but not too much, about her state of mind. Jesse did tell me one thing. She said it was really bizarre that she had invested so much in her career, and now she didn't care about it at all. I had missed Jesse even more than I thought I could. I drove to Jesse's apartment the day she came back. When Jesse opened the door, I was startled by the way she looked. She'd let her hair grow and fan out so that it looked like a sunburst. She was tan and looked as healthy as a California lifeguard in August. She looked as if nothing could ever be wrong in her life. "You look rested and all," I told her. I was feeling a little resentful, actually. She had taken off before the trial had ended. No goodbyes, no explanations. What did that tell me about who she was? She smiled gently. "I'm a lot better, Alex. I think I'm almost healed." She came out onto the porch and into my arms, and I felt a little healed myself. "Tell me everything that's been happening. What's it like to fall off the earth?" I asked. "It's pretty good, actually, falling off the earth. I haven't not worked since I was 16 years old. It was scary the first few days. Then it was fine," she said with her head still buried in my chest. "There was only one thing I missed. I wanted you there with me."
"I would have come," I said.
"I needed to do it the way I did. I had to think everything through one time. I didn't call anybody else, Alex. Not one other person. I found out a lot about myself. Maybe I even found out who Jesse Flanagan really is." I raised her chin up and looked into her eyes. "Tell me what you found out. Tell me who Jesse is." Arm in arm, we went inside the house. But Jesse didn't talk very much about who she was, or what she'd found out about herself down at her lake cottage. We fell into old habits, and ones that, I must admit, I had missed. I wondered if she still cared for me, and just how much she wanted to come back to D.C. Jesse began to unbutton my shirt, and there was no way I was going to stop her. "I did miss you so much," she whispered against my chest. "Did you miss me, Alex?" I had to smile. "Now what do you think? Take a guess." Jesse and I got a little wild that afternoon. I threw myself into work again. I had promised myself that I'd solve the kidnapping case somehow. One miserable, cold, rainy night, I trudged out by myself to see Nina Cerisier again. The Cerisier girl was still the only person who'd actually seen Gary Sinigi's accomplice. I was in the neighborhood anyway. Right. Glory Cerisier wasn't real happy to see me camped on her front doorstep. I'd been standing on the porch for 10 minutes before she finally opened the door. I'd knocked on the dented aluminum door a half dozen times. "Detective Cross, it's late, you know. Can't we be allowed to move on with our lives?" she asked as she finally swung open the door. "It's hard for us to forget the Sanderses. We don't need you to remind us over and over." "I know you don't," I agreed with a tall, late 40-ish woman eyeballing me. Almond-shaped eyes, pretty eyes on a not very pretty face. These are murder cases, though, Mrs. Cerisier. Terrible murders.
The killer has been caught, she said to me. Do you know that, Detective Cross? Do you read newspapers?
I felt like crap being out there again. I believe she suspected I was crazy. She was a smart lady. Oh, Jesus Christ, I shook my head and laughed out loud. You know, you're absolutely right. I'm just fucked up. I'm sorry. I really am. That caught her off guard, and Gloria Cerisier smiled back at me. It was a kindly, crooked-tooth grin that you see sometimes in the projects. Invite this poor nigger in for some coffee, I said. I'm crazy, but at least I know it. Open the door for me.
All right, all right. Why don't you come in then, Detective? We can talk one more time. That's it, though.
That's it, I agreed with her. We drank bad instant coffee in her tiny kitchen. Actually, she loved to talk. Gloria Cerisier asked me all sorts of questions about the trial. She wanted to know what it was like being on TV. Like many people, she was curious about the actress Catherine Rose. Gloria Cerisier even had her own private theory about the kidnapping.
That man didn't do it. That Gary Shinichi or Murphy or whoever he is. Somebody set him up, you see, she said.
I suppose she thought it funny that she was sharing her crazy ideas with a crazy D.C. policeman. Humor me one last time, I said, finally getting around to what I really wanted to talk to her about.
Run me through what Nina said she saw that night. Tell me what Nina told you, as close as you remember it. Why are you doing this to yourself? Why are you here 10 o'clock at night?
I don't know why, Glory. I shrugged and sipped the truly bad-tasting coffee. Maybe it's because I need to know why I was chosen down in Miami. I don't know for sure, but here I am.
It made you crazy, hasn't it? The kidnapping of those children.
Yes, it's made me crazy.
Tell me again what Nina saw. Tell me about the man in the car with Gary Shinichi. Nina, ever since she had been little, she loved the window seat on our stairway.
Glory began the story again.
That's Nina's window on the world. Always has been. She curl up there and read a book. Sometimes she'd just stare out at nothing. She was at the window seat when she saw that white man, Gary Shinichi. We get few white men in the neighborhood, so he caught her eye. The more she watched, the stranger it seemed to her. Like she told you, he was watching the Sanders' house. Like he was spying on the house or something. And the other man, the one in the car, he was watching him watch the house.
Bingo. My tired, overloaded mind somehow managed to catch the key phrase in what she just said. You just said the man in the car was watching Gary Shinichi. You said he was watching him.
I did say that, didn't I? I forgot all about it. Nina been saying the men was together, like a salesman team or something. You know, the way they come stake out a street sometimes. But way back, she told me the man in the car was watching the other one. I believe that what she said. I'm almost sure. Let me get Nina. I'm not so sure anymore.
Soon, the three of us were sitting together and talking. Mrs. Cerisier helped me with Nina, and Nina finally cooperated. Yes, she was sure the man in the car had been watching Gary Shinichi. The man wasn't there with Shinichi. Nina Cerisier definitely remembered the man in the car watching the other man. She didn't know whether it had been a white or black man watching. She hadn't mentioned it before because it didn't seem important. The man in the car had been watching Gary Shinichi. Maybe there hadn't been an accomplice after all, but someone watching Gary Shinichi / Murphy as he staked out potential murder victims? Who could it have been? I was allowed to visit Shinichi / Murphy, but only in connection with the Sanders and Turner murder investigations. I could see him about crimes that probably would never go to trial, but not about one that could possibly remain unsolved. I had a friend out at Falston where Gary was imprisoned. I had known Wallace Hart, the chief of psychiatry at Falston, since I had joined the D.C. police force. Wallace was waiting for me in the lobby of the ancient facility. I like this kind of personal attention, I said as I shook his hand. First time I've ever gotten any, of course.
You're a celebrity now, Alex. I saw you on the tube.
Wallace is a small, scholarly-looking black man who wears round bottle glasses and baggy blue business suits. What do you think about Gary so far? I asked Wallace, as we took a prison elevator up to the maximum security floor. Model prisoner?
I've always had a soft spot for psychopaths, Alex. They keep shit interesting.
You're not buying the possibility of multiple personalities, I take it.
I think it's a possibility, but very slim. Either way, the bad boy in him is really bad. I'm surprised he got caught.
I said, want to hear one off-the-wall theory? Gary Murphy caught Sinigi. Gary Murphy couldn't handle Sinigi, so he turned him in. Wallace grinned at me.
Alex, I do like your crazy mind. But do you really buy that? One side turning in the other?
Nope. I just wanted to see if you would. I'm beginning to think he's a psycho all the way. I just need to know how far all the way is. I observed a definite paranoid personality disorder when I was seeing him.
I agree with that. He's mistrustful, demanding, arrogant, driven. Like I say, I love the guy.
I was a little shocked when I saw Gary this time. His eyes appeared to be sunken into his skull. The skin was pulled tight all around his face. He'd lost a lot of weight, maybe 30 pounds.
So I'm a little depressed. Hello, doctor.
He looked up from his cot and spoke to me. He was Gary Murphy again. Hello, Gary, I said. I couldn't stay away.
Long time no visits. You must want something. Oh, let me guess. You're doing a book about me. You want to be the next Ann Rule?
I shook my head. I wanted to come and see you long before this. I had to get a court order first. I'm here to talk about the Sanders and Turner murders, actually.
Really?
He seemed resigned, and his effect was indifferent and passive. I didn't like the way he looked. It struck me that his personality could be on the verge of complete disintegration. I'm only allowed to talk to you about the Sanders and Turner murders, in fact. That's my purview. But we could talk about Vivian Kim, if you like.
Then we don't have a lot to talk about. I don't know anything about those killings. I haven't even read the newspapers. I swear on my daughter's life I haven't. Maybe our friend Sinigi knows. Not me, Alex.
He seemed real comfortable calling me Alex by now. Your lawyer must have explained the murder cases to you. There could be another trial this year.
I won't see any more lawyers. It's got nothing to do with me. Besides, those cases won't get to trial. Too expensive.
Gary? I talked to him as if he were a patient of mine. I'd like to put you under hypnosis again. Will you sign the papers if I can get all the bullshit arranged? It's important for me to talk to Sinigi. Let me try to talk to him. Gary Murphy smiled and he shook his head. Finally, he nodded.
Actually, I'd like to talk with him myself. If I could, I'd kill him. I would kill Sinigi. Like I'm supposed to have killed all those other people.
That evening, I went to see former Secret Service agent Mike Devine. Devine had been one of the two agents who had been assigned to Secretary Goldberg and his family. I wanted to ask him about the accomplice theory. Mike Devine had taken voluntary retirement about a month after the kidnapping. Because he was still in his mid-40s, I assumed he'd been pushed out of his job. We talked for a couple of hours out on his stone terrace overlooking the Potomac. It was a tasteful, well-appointed apartment for a now single man. Devine was tan and looked rested. He was one of the better advertisements I'd seen for getting out of police work while you can.
My partner and I were pushed out, you know, Devine confessed over a couple of Corona beers. One fuck-up that happened to turn into World War III, and we were both history at the service. We didn't get a lot of support from our boss, either.
It was a public case. I guess there had to be heroes and villains, I said.
Maybe it's all for the best, Mike Devine mused. You ever think about starting over, doing something else while you still have the energy?
I've thought about private practice, I said to Devine. I'm a psychologist.
But you love the job too much to leave it?
Mike Devine grinned and squinted into the late afternoon sunlight coming off the water. Listen, Mike, I wanted to go over, once more, those last couple of days before the kidnapping, I said to him.
You are goddamn hooked, Alex. I've been over every square inch of that territory myself. Believe me, there's nothing there.
I believe you, but I'm still curious about a late model sedan that might have been seen out in Potomac. Possibly a Dodge, I said. It was the car that Nina Ceresia remembered parked on Langley Terrace. You ever notice a blue or black sedan parked on Sorrel Avenue, or anywhere around the day school? Like I said, I've been over and over all our daily logs. There wasn't any mystery car. You can look at the logs yourself. I have, I told him, and laughed at the seeming hopelessness of my case. Mike Devine and I talked for a while more. He couldn't come up with anything new. Something still bothered me, though. The whole accomplice thing. Or the watcher thing. More than that, I had a gut feeling about Devine and his partner. A bad feeling. Something told me they knew more than they were willing to tell anybody. I decided to contact Devine's ex-partner, Charles Chakley, later that same night. After his dismissal, Chakley and his family had settled in Tempe, Arizona. It was midnight my time, 10 o'clock in Tempe. Not too late, I figured. Charles Chakley, this is Detective Alex Cross calling from Washington, I said when he got on the phone. There was a pause, an uncomfortable silence before he answered. Then Chakley got hostile. Real strange, it seemed to me. His reaction only served to fuel my instincts about him and his partner. What the hell do you want? He bristled. Why are you calling me here? I'm retired from the service now. I'm trying to put what happened behind me. Leave me the hell alone. Stay away from me and my family. Listen, I'm sorry to bother you. I started to apologize. He cut me off. Then don't. I could just about picture Charles Chakley as I spoke to him. I remembered him from the days right after the kidnapping. He was only 51, but he looked over 60. Beer belly, most of his hair gone. Sad, kind of withdrawn eyes. Unfortunately, I'm still assigned to a couple of murders, I said to him, hoping he'd understand. They involved Gary Sinigi / Murphy, too. He came back to kill one of the teachers at the school, Vivian Kim. I thought you didn't want to bother me. Why don't you pretend you never called, huh? Then I'll pretend I never picked up the phone. I'm getting good at playing let's pretend out here on the painted desert. Listen, I could get a subpoena. We could have this conversation in Washington. Or I could fly out there and come over to your house in Tempe, show up for a barbecue some night. The goddamn case is over. Leave it alone. And leave me the fuck alone. There was something very strange in Chakley's tone. He sounded ready to explode. I talked to your partner tonight, I said. That kept him on the line. So you talked to Mickey Devine. I talk to him myself now and then. Just answer a question or two. One question. That's it, Chakley finally said. Do you ever remember seeing a dark, late-model sedan parked on Sorrel Avenue, anywhere around the Goldberg or Dunn house, maybe a week or so prior to the kidnapping? Hell no. Christ no. Anything out of the ordinary would have gone in our log. The kidnapping case is closed. Chakley hung up on me. The tone of the conversation had been too weird. The unsolved watcher angle was driving me a little crazy. It was a big loose end. I had to talk to Jesse about Mike Devine and Charlie Chakley and the logs they had kept. Something wasn't checking out about the two of them. They were definitely holding back. Jesse and I spent the day at her lake cottage in North Carolina. She needed to talk. She needed to tell me how she had changed, what she had found out about herself on her sabbatical. Two very, very strange things happened down there in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina. We left Washington at 5 in the morning and got to the lake just before 8:30. It was the 3rd of December, but it could have been the 1st of October. The temperature was in the 70s all afternoon. The summer people were gone for the season, so we had the lake to ourselves. By mutual agreement, we didn't push into any heavy subjects too quickly. Not about Jesse, or Devine and Chakley, or my latest theories on the kidnapping. Late in the afternoon, Jesse and I went for a long trek into the surrounding pine forests. I told you that I found out a lot about myself down here, Alex, Jesse said as we hiked deeper and deeper into the forest. I want to tell you about me. I'm ready to talk now, she said. I need to tell you why, and how, and everything else. I nodded and let her go on. My father was a failure, in his eyes. He was street smart. He could get along so beautifully socially, when he wanted to. But he came from the shanty side, and he let it put a huge chip on his shoulder. My father's negative attitude got him in trouble all the time. He didn't care how it affected my mother or me. He got to be a heavy drinker in his 40s and 50s. At the end of his life, he didn't have one friend. I imagine that's why he killed himself. My father killed himself, Alex. He did it in his unmarked car. There wasn't any heart attack at Union Station. That's a lie I've been telling ever since my college days. We were both silent as we walked on. I didn't want to be a failure like my father or my mother. That's the way they saw themselves, Alex. That's how they talked all the time. Not low esteem, no esteem. I couldn't let myself be like that.
How do you see them?
As failures, I guess. A tiny smile came with the admission. They were both so unbelievably smart. They knew everything about everything. They read every book in the universe. They could talk to you about any subject. Have you ever been to Ireland?
I've been to England once, on police business.
Some villages you go to in Ireland, the people are so articulate, but they live in such poverty. You see these white ghettos. Every third storefront seems to be a pub. There are so many educated failures in that country. I didn't want to be another smart failure. I needed to be number one, no matter what the cost. Then in the Treasury Department, I got ahead, comfortably ahead. Alex, for whatever reasons, I was becoming happy with my career, with my life in general.
But it disintegrated after the Goldberg-Dunn kidnapping. You were the scapegoat. You weren't the golden girl anymore.
Just like that, I was finished. Agents were talking behind my back. Eventually I quit, left the service. I came down here, to figure out who the hell I was. I needed to do it all by myself.
Jessie reached out, and she put her arms around me in the heart of the woods. She began to sob very quietly. I had never seen her cry before. I held Jessie tightly in my arms. I had never felt so close to her before.
We made it back to Jessie's cabin just before it turned dark.
We built a big fire inside and cooked a fine meal that would have fed four. There was sweet white corn, a huge salad, a 20-ounce steak for each of us, a dry white wine. After we ate, we got around to talking about Mike Devine and Charlie Chakley. Jessie couldn't help too much. She told me I was probably looking in the wrong place with the Secret Service agents. She said that Chakley was an excitable type who just might blow up over a call to Arizona. She told me he was bitter on the job, so he'd probably be bitter off it. In her opinion, Mike Devine and Chakley were both good, but not great agents. If something was worth noting during the Goldberg family surveillance, they would have seen it. Their logs would have been accurate. Neither of them was clever enough to pull off a cover-up. Jessie was sure of that. She didn't doubt that Nina Cerisier had seen a car parked on her street the night before the Sanders murder, but she didn't believe that somebody had been watching Sinigi / Murphy, or even that Sinigi had been down near the projects himself.
"I'm not on the case anymore," Jessie finally said to me. "I don't represent the interests of Treasury or anybody else. Here's my honest opinion, Alex. Why don't you just give it up? It's over. Let it go."
"I can't do that," I told Jessie. "Every time I try, something pops up and changes my mind." That night we went to bed fairly early. 9:15. There was still passion, but there was also warmth and tenderness between us. We cuddled, and we laughed, and we didn't go to sleep early. I came home late from work on Monday. Damon and Janelle swarmed all over me as I stomped the dozen paces from the front door to the kitchen.
"Phone, phone, phone,"
Damon chanted as he romped along at my side. Nana was holding the phone out to me from the kitchen. She said it was Wallace Hart calling from Falston Prison.
"Alex, I'm sorry to bother you at home," Wallace said. "Could you swing by here? It might be important."
I was trying to peel my jacket off. I stopped. One arm in, one out.
"What is it, Wallace?"
"He's asking for you. He wants to talk to you and only you. Says it's very important."
"Can it hold till morning?" I asked Wallace. I'd already put in a long day.
"He's Sinigi," Wallace Hart said over the phone. "Sinigi wants to talk to you now." I was speechless. Then I managed. "I'm on my way, Wallace." I arrived at Falston in under an hour. Gary was being housed on the prison building's top floor. When I arrived at his cell, Gary was lying face up on a narrow cot without sheets or a blanket. A guard watched him continuously. I entered Gary's cell and sat. Gary's eyes were pinned to the ceiling. They seemed pushed back into his skull. I was certain he knew that I was there.
"Welcome to my psikushka, doctor,"
he finally said in an eerie, gravelly monotone.
"Do you know psikushka?"
It was Sinigi, all right. The prison hospital's in Russia. It's where they put political prisoners in the Soviet Union, I said.
Very good.
He looked over at me.
I want to make a new deal with you, clean slate.
I'm not aware of any deal.
I don't want to waste any more of my time here. I can't keep playing Murphy. Wouldn't you rather find out what makes Sinigi tick? Sure you would, Dr. Cross. You could be famous yourself. You could be very important in whatever circle you choose to participate in.
I didn't believe this could be a fugue state, one of his escapes. He appeared to be very much in control of what he was saying.
Are you with me so far?
He asked from his cot. You're telling me now that you were fully conscious of everything you did. There was never a split personality. No fugues. You played both parts. Now you're tired of playing Gary Murphy. Sinigi's eyes were focused and extremely intense.
That's right. That's the ticket, Alex. You are so much brighter than the others.
And what do you want from us? What can I do, Gary?
I need a few little things, but mainly, I just want to be myself, so to speak. I want to be recognized for all my achievements.
Do we get anything in return? Sinigi smiled at me.
I'll tell you what happened, from the beginning. I'll help you solve your precious case. I'll tell you, Alex.
I waited for Sinigi to go on.
I had always planned to murder both children. I couldn't wait. I have this love-hate thing with childhood, you know. Cut off breasts and shaved genitals, so my adult victims are more like kiddies. Anyway, killing the little bunions would be the logical and safe conclusion of the whole affair.
Sinigi smiled again.
You're still interested in why I really decided on the kidnapping, aren't you? Why I chose Maggie Rosebud and her friend Shrimpy Goldberg?
I'm interested in everything you have to say, Gary. Go right on.
You know, one time I figured out that I've killed over 200 people, a lot of children, too. I do what I feel like.
Is that true? Are you still trying to shock me? He shrugged.
Why should I? When I was a boy, I read volumes about the Lindbergh kidnapping case. Then all the big crimes. I was fascinated, absolutely enthralled, obsessed with kidnapping children, having them completely under my control. I wanted to torture them, like helpless little birds. I especially like the idea that kidnapping gets the parents so upset. They will destroy other adults. But God forbid if someone takes one little child. What rubbish, what utter hypocrisy. Think about it. 1 million dark-skinned children die in Bangladesh, Dr. Cross. Nobody cares.
Why did you murder the black families in the projects? What's the connection?
Who says there has to be a connection? Maybe those were my good deeds. Think about those victims I chose. Hopeless drug users, a teenage girl who was already a prostitute, a small boy who was already doomed. Actually, I rather like the concept of being the first celebrated serial killer of blacks.
You didn't murder Michael Goldberg? I went back to something he'd said earlier.
No. It wasn't intentional at the time. I would have, everything in good time. He was a spoiled little bunion.
How did the bruises get on Michael Goldberg's body? Tell me what happened.
Well, when I saw that he died on me, I was so angry. I flew into a rage, kicked the fucking body all over the lot, hit it with my digging shovel. I don't remember what else I did. I was so pissed. Then I threw his dead ass in that river.
But you didn't harm the girl? You didn't hurt Maggie Rose Dunn?
No, I didn't hurt the girl.
Tell me about her. What really happened to Maggie Rose Dunn?
All right, the Maggie Rose Dunn story. After the abduction, she was groggy. The first time I looked in on her, anyway, she was coming off the secobarbital. I played Mommy Terror for little Maggie. I sounded the way Mommy T used to sound at the basement door in our house. Stop your crying! Shut up, you spoiled little bunion! That scared her pretty good, I'll tell you. Then I put her out again. I carefully checked both of their pulses because I was certain the fibers would require some evidence that the children were alive.
Their pulses were both all right?
Yes, just fine, Alex. I put my ear to each little chest. I controlled my natural urge to stop heartbeats rather than preserve them.
Why the national kidnapping? Why all the publicity? Why take such a big chance?
Because I was ready. I'd been practicing for a long, long time. I wasn't taking any chances. I also needed the money. I deserve to be a millionaire. Everybody else is.
You came back to check the children again the following day?
The next day she was fine, too. But the day after Michael Goldberg died, Maggie Rose was gone. I drove into the barn, and there was the hole in the ground where I buried the box. Big hole in the ground. Empty. I didn't harm her. I didn't get the ransom money down in Florida, either. Somebody else has it. Now you have to figure out what happened, detective. I think I have. I think I know the big secret.
I thought I knew where he was going with all of this, what he was going to tell me soon. Still, I needed to have my opinion confirmed by him.
I always tried to take proper precautions, without breaking the spell. I had figured out escape routes, ways in and out of every neighborhood that I entered. One of these involved a sewer system tunnel that goes from the edge of the ghetto out to Capitol Hill. I had a change of clothing inside the tunnel, including a wig. I'd thought of everything. I wouldn't get caught. I was very confident about my abilities. I believed in my own omnipotence.
Do you still believe in your omnipotence?
What happened back then, my one mistake, was I permitted my successes, the applause of millions of admirers, to rush to my head. The applause can be a drug. Catherine Rose suffers from the same disease, you know. Most of the movie people, the sports icons, they do too. Millions are cheering for them, you understand? And some of the stars forget any limitations they might have, forget the hard work that got them to the plateau originally. I did. At the time. That is precisely why I was caught. I believed I could escape from the McDonald's just as I had always escaped before. I would just dabble in a little spree killing, then get away.
When you scouted the Goldberg and Dunn houses, were you at the height of your powers?
No, no, no. As you know, Doctor, I was already becoming sloppy. I'd read too many news accounts of my perfect killing in Condon Terrace. No traces, no clues, the perfect killer. Even I was impressed.
What went wrong out in Potomac? I thought I knew the answer. I needed him to confirm it. He shrugged.
I was being followed, of course.
Here we go, I thought to myself. The Watcher. You didn't know it at the time?
Of course not.
He frowned at the question.
I realized I was being followed much later. Then it was confirmed at the trial.
How was that? How did you find out you were being followed? Suniji stared into my eyes.
Let me stop to make a point. This one is important to me. I have secrets to tell you. Lots of big and little secrets. Dirty secrets, juicy secrets. I'm going to give you one secret now. Do you know why?
Elementary, my dear Gary, I told him. It's hell for you to be under the control of others. You need to be in charge.
That's very good, Dr. Detective. But I do have some neat things to trade. Crimes that go all the way back to when I was 12 and 13 years old. There are major unsolved crimes that go back that far. Believe me, I have a treasure trove of goodies to share with you.
I understand. I can't wait to hear about them.
You always did understand. All you have to do is convince the other zombies to walk and chew juicy fruit at the same time.
The other zombies? I smiled at a slip.
Sorry. I didn't mean to be rude. Can you convince the zombies? You know who I mean. You have less respect for them than I do.
That was true enough. I'd have to convince Chief of Detectives Pittman for one. You'll help me out? Give me something concrete? I have to find out what happened to the little girl. Let her parents have some peace at last.
All right. I will do that. I didn't notice any surveillance back then. And none of what I'm going to tell you about happened near the Sanders house. It occurred on Sorrel Avenue in Potomac, in front of the Goldberg house, in fact.
Go on. What happened out in Potomac? What did you see at the Goldbergs? Who did you see?
I drove by there one of those nights before the kidnapping. A man was walking on the sidewalk. I thought nothing of him. It never registered until I saw the same man at the trial.
Shinichi stopped talking for a moment. He stared at me as if he were looking right into my soul. Who was the man you recognized at the trial?
It was the Secret Service agent. It was Divine. He and his pal Chakley must have seen me watching the Goldberg and Dunn houses. They were the ones who followed me. They took precious Maggie Rose. They got the ransom in Florida. You should have been looking for cops all this time. Two cops murdered the little girl.
My hunch about Divine and Chakley had been right after all. Shinichi / Murphy was the only eyewitness, and he'd confirmed it. Now we had to move. I had to personally reopen the Dunn Goldberg case, and with news that no one in Washington would want to hear. I decided to talk to the FBI first. Two cops had murdered Maggie Rose. The investigation had to be opened up again. I dropped in on my old buddy of buddies, Jerry Scorse, at FBI headquarters. After I cooled my heels for 40 minutes in reception, Scorse brought me coffee and invited me into his office. "Come right in, Alex. Thanks for waiting." He listened politely and with apparent concern as I went over what I had previously learned, and then what Shinichi told me concerning Secret Service agents Mike Divine and Charles Chakley. He took notes, a lot of notes. After I had finished, Scorse said, "I have to make a phone call. Sit tight, Alex." When he returned, he asked me to come upstairs with him. He never said it, but I assumed he was impressed by the news from Gary Shinichi. I was escorted to the deputy director's private conference room on the top floor. The deputy, Kurt Wythus, is the number two person at the bureau. Scorse went with me into the impressive, very cushy conference room. Yellow pads and pencils were laid out for us. It was clearly Wythus' meeting from the start. "What we'd like to accomplish is twofold, Detective Cross." Wythus spoke and acted like a very successful, very cool Capitol Hill lawyer. "I'd like to show you all the information we have on Agents Divine and Chakley. In return, we must ask for your full cooperation in keeping this matter absolutely confidential. What I'm telling you now is that we've known about them for a while, Detective. We were running a parallel investigation to your own." "You have my cooperation," I said. "But I'm going to have to file a report back at the department." "I've already spoken to your commanding officer about the matter," Wythus said. "You've been ahead of us a couple of times during the investigation. This time, maybe we're a little ahead of you. Half a step." Scorse took over for Wythus at that point. "We started our investigation of Agents Divine and Chakley at the time of the kidnapping," he said. "There were obvious suspects, though not ones we took seriously. During the course of the investigation, a great deal of pressure was placed on both men. Since the Secret Service reports directly to the Secretary of the Treasury, you can imagine what they were subjected to." "I watched most of it firsthand," I reminded both FBI men. Scorse nodded, then went on. "On the 4th of January, Agent Charles Chakley resigned from the service. He stated that he'd been thinking about the move long before the kidnapping anyway. He said he couldn't handle the innuendos, all the media attention. His resignation was accepted immediately. At about the same time, a small error in the daily logs kept by the agents was discovered by us. A date had been inadvertently reversed. It was nothing major, except that we were checking everything about the case at that time. We eventually got 900 of our agents directly or indirectly involved," the deputy director added. "Other inconsistencies in the agents' logs were eventually discovered," Scorse continued. "Our technical experts concluded that two of the individual reports had been doctored, that is, rewritten. We ultimately came to believe that what was taken out were references to the teacher, Gary Shinichi." "They had spotted him checking out the Goldberg house in Potomac," I said, "if Shinichi can be believed." "On this point, I think he can. What you've recently had confirmed corresponds to our findings. We believe that the two agents observed Shinichi watching Michael Goldberg and Maggie Rose Dunn. We think one of the agents followed Shinichi and discovered the hiding place in Crisfield, Maryland." "You've been watching the two agents ever since?" I asked Jerry Scorse. He nodded once. "For a couple of months, anyway. We also have good reason to believe they know we're watching." 2 weeks after Chakley resigned, Divine also resigned from the service. I assume Chakley and Devine haven't tried to spend any of the money, I said. To our knowledge, no. As I said before, they know we're suspicious. They aren't dumb. It's come down to a rather delicate and intricate waiting game, Wytha said. We can't prove anything yet, but we can disrupt their lives. We can sure as hell keep them from spending any of the ransom money. What about the pilot in Florida? Did you ever find out who he was? I asked. Scorse nodded. The FBI had been withholding a lot from me, from everybody. I wasn't surprised. He turned out to be a drug runner named Joseph Denyeau. He was known to some of our people in Florida. It's conceivable that Devine knew Denyeau and hired him. What happened to this Joseph Denyeau? I asked. Denyeau was murdered in Costa Rica. His throat was cut. He wasn't supposed to be found. You're not going to bring Devine and Chakley in at this point? I asked. We don't have any proof, Alex. None. Nothing that will hold up. What you got from Suniji cements it, but won't help in court. What happened to the little girl? I asked Wythus. Wythus didn't say anything. We don't know, Scorse answered. There's still nothing on Maggie Rose. That's the amazing thing in all this. There's another complication, Wythus said to me. I'm sure there are a lot of complications, I said to the deputy director. Wythus glanced at Agent Scorse. Then he looked back at me. Jessie Flanagan is the complication. We believe she's deeply involved in this with the two men. Has been from the start. Jessie Flanagan and Mike Devine have been lovers for years. At 8:30 that night, Samson and I walked along New York Avenue. He had just asked me how I was holding up. Not too good, thanks. Yourself? I said. He knew about Jessie Flanagan. I told him everything I knew. I couldn't have felt any worse than I did that night. Scorse and Wythus had laid out a thorough case involving Jessie. She'd done it. There was no room for doubt. One lie had led to another. She told me 100 if she told me one. You want me to keep my mouth shut, or to talk at you? Samson asked me. I'll do it either way. I want to talk, I told John. I could use a cocktail. I need to talk about psychopathic liars. I'll buy us a few drinks, Samson said. We headed toward Faces. It's a bar we've been going to since we first joined the police force. The crowd in Faces is mostly black, but white people come by for the jazz. Jessie was the one who assigned Devine and Chakley in the first place? Samson reviewed the facts as we waited for the stoplight at Fifth Street. Right. That's how it all started. Devine and Chakley were one of the teams assigned to Secretary Goldberg and his family. They worked under Jessie. And nobody ever suspected them? Samson asked me. Not at first. The FBI checked them out. They checked everybody out. Chakley's and Devine's daily logs were off. That's when they became suspicious. Some watchdog analysts at the Bureau figured out that the logs had been doctored. They had 20 people for every one we had. Besides that, the FBI removed the doctored logs so none of us could find them. Devine and Chakley spotted Suniji checking out one of the kids, Samson said. They followed Suniji and his van out to the farm in Maryland, I said. They realized they were stalking a potential kidnapper. Somebody got the idea to kidnap the kids after the actual kidnapping. $10 million idea, Samson glowered. Was Ms. Jessie Flanagan in on it from the beginning? I don't know. I think so. I'll have to ask her about that sometime.
Robert Fischenauer was a supervisor at Falston Prison. Today, he thought, that was a very good thing. Fischenauer believed that he just might know where the $10 million in kidnap money was hidden, at least a large part of the ransom. He was going to take a little peekaboo right now. He also had a pretty good idea that Gary Suniji / Murphy was still messing with everybody's head. As Fischenauer drove his Pontiac Firebird down Route 50 in Maryland, a host of questions was circulating through his head. Was Suniji / Murphy the kidnapper? Did he really know where the ransom money was? Fischenauer figured he would know everything pretty soon. Another few miles of state road and he'd know more than anybody, except for Suniji / Murphy himself.
The turnoff was the seldom-used back way into the old farm. The road was almost completely gone now. Fishnell saw this as he made the right turn off the main highway. The vegetation was knocked down. Someone had come crashing through here in the past few months. Was it the FBI and local police? They'd probably searched the farmhouse grounds a dozen times. Around 5:30 in the afternoon, Fischenauer pulled his dusty red Firebird up alongside a dilapidated garage just to the left of the main farmhouse. Gary had raved about how Bruno Hauptmann had hidden part of the Lindbergh ransom in his garage in New York City. Hauptmann had been trained as a carpenter, and he'd built a secret compartment for the money into a wall in his garage. Gary said he'd done something like that out at the old farm in Maryland. He'd sworn it was the truth, and that the FBI would never find it. Fischenauer switched off the Firebird's rumbling engine. The sudden quiet was eerie. Weeds were growing everywhere, even springing out of the roof of the garage. Water stains ran down the sides of the garage.
"Well, Gary boy, let's see if you're completely full of shit. I hope to hell you're not."
Robert Fischenauer took a deep breath and climbed out of his low-slung car. He'd already figured out what he would say if he got nailed here. He'd just say that Gary had told him where he'd buried Maggie Rose Dunn, but Fischenauer had figured it was only some of his crazy talk. Still, it had gnawed at him. So now here he was in Creepsville, Maryland, checking it out. Actually, he felt dumb. He also felt kind of bad, guilty. But he had to check this one for himself. This was his personal $10 million lottery. He had his ticket. Maybe he was about to find out where little Maggie Rose Dunn was buried. Jesus, he hoped not. He and Gary Boy had talked a lot, for hours at a time, back at the hole. Gary loved to talk about his exploits. His baby, as he called the kidnapping caper. And here Robert Fischenauer was, right at the scene of the crime. There was a badly rusted metal latch on the door. Fischenauer slipped on a pair of winter golf gloves. Hard to explain those if he got caught snooping out here. He flipped up the door latch. He had to pull the door hard toward him through the thick overgrowth. Flashlight time. He took out his lamp and turned it on full blast. Gary said he'd find the money on the right side of the garage, the far right corner, to be exact. A lot of old, broken-down farm machines lay all around the garage, cobwebs stuck against his face and neck as he walked forward. Halfway into the garage, Fischenauer stopped and turned around. He stared out the open door and listened for what must have been a full 90 seconds. He sure hoped there was no one around. How long could the FBI afford to watch a deserted farm? Almost 2 years after the kidnapping. Satisfied that he was alone, Fischenauer started to work. He pulled a sturdy old workbench over. Gary had said the bench would be there. Standing on the old workbench, Fischenauer began to pull away old boards, up where the garage roof met the wall. There was a space back there, just like Gary said there was. Fischenauer aimed his flashlight into the hole in the wall. There it was. Part of the ransom money that Gary Sinigi / Murphy wasn't supposed to have. He couldn't believe his eyes. A stack of money was right there in the garage walls. At 3:16 the following morning, Gary Sinigi / Murphy pressed his forehead against the cold metal bars that separated his cell from the prison corridor. He had another big part to act out. Hell's a poppin'. He started to throw up under the highly polished linoleum floor just as he had planned to. He was violently ill inside the cell. He yelled for help between wheezing gasps. Both of the night guards came running. There had been a suicide watch on Gary since his first day there. Lawrence Volpe and Philip Halliard were veterans of many years' service at the federal prison. They weren't too keen on disturbances in the cell block, particularly after midnight.
"What the hell's the matter with you?" Volpe yelled as he watched the green and brown puddles slowly spreading on the floor. "What's your problem, asshole?"
"I think I've been poisoned."
Sinigi / Murphy gasped and wheezed, the sound coming from deep inside his chest.
"Somebody's poisoned me. I've been poisoned."
Best news I've heard lately, Philip Halliard said to his partner and grinned. Wish I'd thought of it first. Poison the bastard. Volpe took out his walkie-talkie and called for the night supervisor. The suicide watch on Suniji was a big deal with the prison higher-ups. It sure wasn't going to happen on Volpe's shift.
I'm going to be sick again,
Gary Suniji slash Murphy moaned. He sagged heavily against the bars and threw up a second time, violently. Moments later, the floor's supervisor arrived. Lawrence Volpe quickly told his boss what had happened.
He says he's been poisoned, Bobby. I don't know what the hell happened. It's possible. Enough of these bastards hate his guts.
I'll take him downstairs to the hospital myself, Robert Fischenauer said to his men.
They'll have to pump his stomach, I guess, if there's anything left to pump. Cuff him for me good, hands and legs.
Moments later, Gary Suniji slash Murphy figured he was halfway to daylight. The prison elevator was padded. The walls were covered with heavy cloth mats. Other than that, it was ancient and painfully slow.
You all right? Fischenauer asked as he and Gary Suniji slash Murphy descended, seemingly inch by inch.
A single bare light bulb protruded from a hole in the mats. It cast a dim light.
Am I all right? What does it look like? I made myself good and sick. I am sick, Suniji slash Murphy told him. Why the hell doesn't this thing move faster?
You going to puke again?
It's entirely possible. A small price to pay.
Suniji slash Murphy managed a thin smile.
A very small price, Bobby.
The elevator bypassed the next floor and the next. It was non-stop. It dropped all the way to the basement of the building, where it landed with a hollow thump.
We see anybody, we're going for X-rays, Fischenauer said as the elevator door opened. X-ray is down here in the basement.
Yes, I'm aware of the plan. It's my plan, said Gary Suniji slash Murphy.
Because it was past 3 in the morning, they saw no one as they started their walk down the long tunnel in the prison basement. Halfway through the tunnel, there was a side door. Fischenauer used his key to open it. There was another short stretch of silent, empty hallway. Then they were at a security door. This was where the shit would hit the fan, and Suniji slash Murphy had to do his stuff. This was where Fischenauer would see if Gary Suniji slash Murphy was as good as his reputation. Fischenauer didn't have a key to the security door.
Give me your gun now, Bobby. Just think about $10 million. I can do this next bit, so all you have to worry about is your part of the money.
This was it.
Suniji made it sound so easy.
Fischenauer reluctantly handed over his revolver.
There's nothing fancy here, Bobby, but this will work. You play everything to Kessler. Look real scared.
There were 2 prison guards on the other side of the security door. A waist-high plexiglass window gave them a view of the unbelievable sight coming their way. They saw Suniji slash Murphy with a gun stuck to the left temple of Supervisor Bob Fischenauer. Suniji slash Murphy had on arm and leg cuffs, but he also had a gun. Both guards stood up fast. They held their riot shotguns above the glass. They didn't have time to make another move.
You're gawking at a dead guard!
Gary screamed at the top of his voice.
Unless you open the fucking door in about 5 seconds! Please!
Fischenauer suddenly screamed at his fellow guards.
He killed Volpe upstairs!
It took less than 5 seconds for an older guard, Stephen Kessler, to make his decision. He turned the key that opened the security door. Kessler was a friend of Robert Fischenauer's, and Suniji had counted on that. The two of them headed for Fischenauer's car. The Firebird was parked close to the front gate. Fischenauer had left the sports car door unlocked. They were inside the car in a flash.
Very nice wheels, Bobby, said Gary Suniji slash Murphy. Now you'll be able to buy a Lamborghini.
Suniji lay down across the back seat. He slid under a blanket that Fischenauer's collie usually slept on.
Now let's get out of this rat trap, Suniji slash Murphy said from the back.
Robert Fischenauer started up the Firebird. Less than a mile from the prison, they changed cars. A Bronco was parked on the street, and they quickly jumped inside. A few minutes later, they were on the highway. A little less than 90 minutes later, the Bronco turned onto the overgrown driveway of the old farm in rural Maryland.
During the ride, Sonigi/Murphy had allowed himself the small but exquisite pleasure of savoring his original master plan. He loved the idea that 2 years before, he'd actually thought to leave some cash hidden in the garage. Not the ransom money, of course. Just for this moment in time. "Are we there yet?" Gary Sonigi/Murphy finally spoke up from under the blanket. Fischenauer didn't answer right away, but Gary knew that they were there by the bumps in the road. He sat up in the cramped back seat of the Bronco. He was almost home free home. "It's time to get rich," he said, and laughed out loud. "Do you plan to take off these matching cuffs at some point?" Robert Fischenauer didn't bother to turn around. As far as he was concerned, this was still a keeper-keepee relationship. "As soon as I have my part of the ransom money," he spoke out of the corner of his mouth, "then, and only then, you're free." As the Bronco very slowly bumped along down memory lane, Gary Sonigi/Murphy brought both his hands down over Fischenauer's head and viciously around his throat. Element of surprise in that. He forced the metal of the cuffs straight back into the prison guard's Adam's apple. Fischenauer began to thrash and struggle fiercely. He couldn't breathe. His knees cracked up hard under the dashboard and the steering wheel. Fischenauer managed to get his legs all the way over to the passenger side of the front seat. His work boot kicked the ceiling of the Bronco. His torso was twisted sideways. He gasped. Fischenauer's struggling eased off and finally stopped, except for some twitching of his limbs. Gary Sonigi/Murphy was on the loose again. Jesse Flanagan walked down the hall to room 427 inside the Marbury Hotel in Georgetown. She wasn't happy about this secretive meeting and wondered what it was about. Jesse wrapped her knuckles against the door. She peered around behind her.
"It's open. Come on in,"
she heard from inside. Jesse opened the door and saw him lounging on the couch. He'd gotten a suite, which was a bad sign. He wanted to bum money.
"Suites for the suite," Mike Devine smiled from the couch. He was watching the Redskins on TV, cool as could be.
"Michael, this is very dangerous right now." Jesse stepped into the hotel room and shut the door, bolted it.
"Dangerous or not, we have to talk. You know, your boyfriend came to see me recently. He was parked outside my building this morning."
"He's not my boyfriend. I've been pumping him for information that we've needed."
Mike Devine smiled. "You pump him, he pumps you. Is everybody happy? I'm not."
Jesse sat down next to Devine on the couch. He was definitely sexy, and he knew it. He had Paul Newman's looks, minus the unbearably beautiful blue eyes. "I shouldn't be here, Michael. We shouldn't be together now." Jesse rubbed her head against his shoulder.
"Yeah, you should be here, Jesse. What good is all this money if we can't spend it and we can't be together?"
"I seem to remember a few days down at the lake recently. Did I imagine that?"
"To hell with stolen moments. Come to Florida with me."
Jesse kissed his throat. He was clean-shaven and he always smelled nice. She unbuttoned his shirt and slid her hand in. Then she let her fingers graze the lump in his trousers.
"We might have to get rid of Alex Cross. I'm serious," he said in a whisper. "You hear me, Jesse?"
"It's a serious thing to say. Let me work on it a little. I'll find out what Alex knows. Be patient."
"You're fucking him, Jesse. That's why you're patient."
"No, I'm not." She was undoing his belt, being a little clumsy with her left hand. She needed to keep him in line for a while longer.
"How do I know you haven't fallen for Alex Cross?" he persisted.
"Because, Michael, I'm in love with you." She pushed closer to Devine and held him. He was easy to fool. They all were. All she had to do now was wait out the FBI, and they were home free. Perfect. The crime of the century.
I was asleep when I got the call at 4 in the morning. A devastated Wallace Hart was on the line. He was calling from Falston, where he had a serious problem on his hands. An hour later, I was at the prison.
I was one of four privileged insiders secreted in Wallace's cramped, overheated office. The press hadn't been told about the sensational escape yet. Wallace Hart was slumped over his paper-littered desk as if he'd been gut-shot. The others in the office were the prison warden and the prison's attorney. "What do you know about this missing guard?" I asked Wallace at the first opportunity.
"His name's Fischenauer, 36 years old.